Welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Today I'm excited to speak to a colleague and dear friend, Kristen Leal, an expert anatomist, a wonderful yoga teacher, and a just generally great person. She's going to share with us some exciting news. She's got a new book. So we'll hear all about it and hear what Kristen's up to. Enjoy. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Peter.
How's it going?
It's going good. How's it going on your side?
It's going good now that we got everything sorted out. It was feeling very weird here electronically.
Oh.
But, well, you know, it's just energy.
Like it's everything. All illusion.
Yes. Nothing really matters. And the cat went to sleep.
Finally.
Yeah. That's cool. Well, I'm glad because the cat was busy devouring your book, Meta Anatomy, Anatomy of a Yogi, Volume 2, Body Poetry.
Apparently it's all the rage with
it's
the cats.
It's tasty.
It's a tasty, tasty book.
It's a tasty morsel of a book. We got two, I guess they don't call them canines on cats, but we got the two tooth marks right there.
Let's go with that. Yeah.
It's always fun over here at the Leal residence. Well, so I'm excited about your new book.
Thank you. I am as well.
Yeah. So why was there a desire to write a second book after your fantastic first book?
Oh, well, thank you. I forced myself to call the last one Volume 1.
Because I thought
that would compel me to write a second one.
Right.
And I don't think I fully understood what the second one was going to be until last year, and it kind of gelled in my head. But just working with the physical or Western anatomical model is really just half the story. And I didn't know how to write a book about all anatomy all at once, so I felt the urge to cover the more energetic maps of the body in this second volume. And I'm happy I did. I'm happy with how it came out, and I'm excited for it to be out in the world.
Nice. So another way to say what you just said might be that your first volume was a lot of what somebody might see in a typical anatomy class if they were taking a teacher training or something like that. And then this is looking at anatomy from a yogi perspective.
Yeah, I was hopeful that the first one also had a yoga framework, tantra yoga framework. So it's not just memorizing muscles and bones, but putting it in context of movement and putting it in context of the philosophy in which we both care so deeply about.
Right.
And
I think it totally did that.
It's easier to work from the gross to the subtle. So if you're just coming into a teacher training or coming into a yoga practice, often you start first with the asana, the physical, let's move my meat around and learn about what is my hand, what is my foot, where are they going?
Right.
And so but once you start kind of embarking on those practices, you start to open yourself to these more subtle experiences of, I feel when I move my arm, there's a connection to my breath or a connection to my physiology or a connection to a line of energy or what is that? And so the second one, I think, is more subtle exploration using these different kind of topographical maps that yogis use of what I call the experience of being alive in your body. Mm. So not just the experience of your bicep, but the experience of your emotions, the experience of your breath, experience of the more subtle you.
It's interesting because, you know, we usually think of those things that you just described as the energy component. And yet, when you talk to more traditional scientists about that word energy, they have no connection to it in that regard. They think of it as a calorie.
Right, right. Energy, consciousness, these words have so many different definitions depending on who you're talking to, right? I think when I first started learning about, you know, back in the Jivamukti era of my life in the 90s, they used to talk about chakras being kind of whirling vortices of energy, rainbow colored, and it was very easy to roll my eyes and consider it some crunchy yoga granola talk, the hippy dippy stuff, and because I didn't have a framework for that, and I didn't have the subtlety to experience what these kind of hubs of energy were. I didn't have the language for it, right?
So I think experience is probably an even better word that you used.
You need the experience before you can language it. But I think as we evolve or as we have these different experiences, then we can start putting, and we get excited to talk about them. And if I'm trying to talk to you about the experience of being alive in my meat suit, I need poetry.
Yeah.
I need metaphor. I need a song. I need something to try to talk about these less tangible, more subtle kind of experiences of whether you call it your physiology, your emotion, your chemical, your proteins, the metabolism of your calories. But there's an experience of that. There's an experience of your processes. And we need maps and models and mantra and poetry to begin to convey that to one another. My hope is with this book that it makes it a little bit more accessible to someone who is like me, who didn't have, who kind of just, it was very easy to dismiss it as being made up. When you see all these traditions being different and using different languages, it's also very easy just to throw up your hands and say, well, it's all made up and all these different words and... but my hope was with the book was give us all kind of a language, and with the meditations in the book, kind of an experience, a direct, more direct experience of these concepts that maybe would seem just harder to connect to, harder to language.
Right. Do you address that notion of it being different and different?
I do.
Yeah. What do you say about that?
I think it, it used to frustrate the heck out of me. I'm trying hard not to swear.
It's 2019.
I know. My new thing. but it used to frustrate me that the different, especially, so I was studying for, with Alan I've known him now for maybe 11 years, and then studying with Rod Stryker for the last 6 years. And there's different languaging, and there's a whole different reversal of ideas or concepts or where these things are in the body and what they are and how we relate to them. And it was really frustrating. And I really, at first, when I first started writing, it tried to come up with a consensus and write that this is the consensus. This is where it is. And it wasn't working. It was very there was a lot of blocks in writing it because there is no consensus.
Right.
There's many differences of opinions, but there's more similarity than differences, I think. Because it is the experience of being alive. Like if I said I have feelings for you, I'm more likely to touch my heart than my toe, right? Like no matter what language I speak.
Right.
You know, or if I say I want, you know, I'm more likely to not touch my eyeball or my brain or my head, but I'm more likely to touch the very center point of my chest because that's the embodied experience of where I live, right? Of who I am underneath all of it is the direct center point. So I tried to say, you know, in the book, let's let the difference, I mentioned the differences where I can or where I, you know, have understood them to be, but say let it richen the conversation so that you can have an experience. Here's a laboratory experiment, right? And you can enter into it, have your own experience of it, and then sit with that. And what do you feel? Like, right. What is it? What's resonant for right. you here? What does it matter to you? Yeah. How do you describe it?
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think it's one thing if you're like an academic and you're doing a survey.
Yeah.
But if the point is to do yoga, it is ultimately about what is your experience.
Yeah, you're never going to CAT scan a chakra.
Right.
I mean, you're not going to find it.
Yeah.
So why is it valuable to you? Is it valuable to you? You know?
Yeah.
It is.
Well, it's useful. I mean, because I did the same thing. I had to have come to terms myself because, you know, in my own house, we have two different maps of certain things. And,
right.
and you know, because of different studies that people do. But, you know, I finally decided the universe is multilingual, you know, and you just have to provide the key.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we're speaking French today.
Mm-hmm.
So the earth line is on the inside.
Yeah.
Tomorrow when we're speaking, you know, Swahili, it'll move to the outside.
Yeah.
But it's consistent within the system.
Mm-hmm. But the maps are meant to be useful.
Yeah.
Right? They're meant to be practiced. They're meant to be experienced.
And I think when you use them
yeah.
with a consistency, they work.
Yeah.
And that's the magical thing.
Yeah.
You know, magic in the good sense, in the best sense, not the it's a fantasy or it's made up, but
mm-hmm.
there is a magic to it, the siddhi of it,
mm-hmm.
the power that comes from understanding what you're working with. Well, that's cool that you addressed that. And so when you... I had to close the table of contents so the cat wouldn't eat the book. But
such a naughty cat.
when you organized it, then
mm-hmm.
what was your thinking in terms of how you went through these esoteric systems?
I think I tried to start with just like what we were saying, an overview of there are different languaging. In different traditions, there is different languaging in different traditions. There's different maps and models, but all of it is an experience of being alive.
Mm-hmm.
And yogis experience themselves as these multidimensional figures, not just the bones and
right.
cat scannable things.
Right.
And so then I started taking kind of bit by bit, like little bite-sized pieces of what are nadis, what are the chakras, how is the breath involved with these different diaphragms and the relationship to the bandhas and the grantees? What is the heart's place in all of this, both anatomically and also emotionally or energetically, experientially? What is the experience of your heart? What's the right. experience of your digestive system and agni? What role does your brain play in all of this? And I tried to just go through, even though the body is not meant to be ultimately subdivided, it doesn't work
right.
as like small little units. It works as a connected whole. I tried to weave that concept through as we look at, you know, different perspectives or different body parts
right.
and how they relate to the larger yoga practice.
Yeah, I guess I think of that as a kind of a balancing act in itself, right?
Yeah.
You can address something in a particular place, but really we're always all of our things.
Yes.
Including our emotional thing, including whatever situation we're having to deal with in the moment.
Yeah.
Like how do you unpack that whole thing and then address it somewhere?
Yeah, and as teachers, you know, I feel like there is a balancing act to be had because you have 3 hours to mm-hmm. teach a concept, a chakra or a body part or an aspect of the philosophy, but it's too reductive to think all of those things exist in and of themselves without the greater context.
Right.
Right. So it is hard because people have to learn the vocabulary and
yeah.
get introduced to it. So we have to break things into smaller bits, but without losing the view that it is all interconnected
mm-hmm.
and interdependent.
Yeah.
And which I think is the larger yoga
right.
story that we're telling. Mm-hmm. You know, not just that your bicep and breath are connected or the right. chakras and, you know, but we are one another. We are connected and right. not interdependent.
Right.
It's an interwoven system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's this temptation when you're first learning about the pieces to start thinking, oh, great, I'll put together something that teaches this piece and then this piece and then this piece.
Yeah.
But they're too interconnected for that level of approach.
Yeah. It kind of simplifies it so much that it becomes unreal.
Yeah.
And unuseful.
It's theoretical.
Theoretical, yeah. So I'm kind of glad I didn't write this 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I had the urge to write an anatomy book.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been teaching workshops and trainings, anatomy trainings and stuff. But it was much more, your bicep goes from here to here. It's innervated with this nerve and this,
yeah.
you know. And
yeah.
holy cow, what a snooze.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's but I'm
different.
Sure 10 years from now,
right.
goodness.
Yeah.
10 years from now, I'll be.
Yeah. You talk about, if I could maybe pick one chapter
sure.
as a little example. You talk about the breath and the four diaphragms.
Yeah.
Is that a fruitful one to have a little chat about?
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yay.
Yeah.
Cool.
What you couldn't see is I was pointing to that one.
You were. Maybe I could through my, you know.
Your yoga cities.
My visual vayu. My rear view vayu.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's not in the book. I should have put that in.
Yeah. So you can use that in your classes.
Yeah. It's now, I've stolen that completely.
Yeah,
the breath is... you know, I relate the diaphragms. I'm sure it's not my original thought. Who knows whose original thought it was, but relating the diaphragms almost to like a school of jellyfish
mm-hmm.
swimming together.
Mm.
And it's we often look at the thoracic diaphragm as the prime mover of respiration, and we give that a lot of discussion time and practice. But as you grow the subtlety, you start to recognize it's not just your thorax breathing. It's not just your exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide, but there's a layer of subtlety, of prana, of movement globally throughout the body. And that's assisted and dammed and rerouted and supported by these other diaphragms, these kind of on a physical level, kind of helper muscles, right, or helper tissues, but on an energetic level, these areas where, you know, when I went to Berlin was the first time I actually saw this, but the dam system, the locks,
mm-hmm.
where you're in a boat, and
yeah.
then you kind of get into this one little lock, and they have to fill it with water, and your boat rises, and then you can go into another area of the canal. I had heard about that before, but I...
And you hadn't experienced it.
I hadn't experienced it before. So my first
trip... Because I grew up in D.C. where we had a canal.
Oh, and they have those there? The
yeah.
little locks and...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
In Georgetown.
Oh, interesting. I haven't seen them there, but... So it was you know, revelatory
yeah,
when
yeah.
I saw it. I
oh,
like,
this is oh, that lock is thing that. I've been talking
yeah.
about. Yeah.
but that's, you know, what these bandhas are and what these diaphragms, they either help to facilitate... the movement of breath or the exaggerated breath as we exaggerate in these pranayama techniques or in asana, but they also can be these useful energetic dams to pool and lift and redirect and channel the flows of prana in our body. And so I thought it was worth a chapter on its own to
yeah.
talk about both the Western anatomical model of these body parts, but also... the power and the potential that
so
they hold.
For people who maybe haven't heard of this before, what are these other diaphragms that
yeah.
you're talking about? So, anatomically.
Yeah, most famously, the thoracic diaphragm, which is kind of subdivides you into top and bottom bits. It's a one big old muscle with a lot of interconnections. It looks like kind of a mushroom cap or an open umbrella shape underneath your ribs. And then less popular, but still quite cool, the pelvic diaphragm, which is a series of overlapping hammocks of muscles with some apertures for exit to the external world. And then the vocal diaphragm, which is a kind of muscle and cartilage. And I always think of it like if you've ever like go to the opera or the theater and they have those big red curtains that open and close and they kind of have a flourish to them. That always reminds me of the vocal diaphragm. And then the super cool, super subtle, I refer to it as a brain diaphragm, but it's a series of fascial gift wrap over the brain and in different placements in and around the brain that actually has acknowledged, from a Western perspective, has acknowledged movement with the breath, albeit incredibly small and very subtle, but perceptible and able to be experienced in these different techniques that we do.
So as you're breathing, all of these diaphragms are at play.
At play, yeah. And that's such a good way of saying it. Some are actively participating and actually bringing the breath into the body, right? Creating the space for the inspiration to fill you in the body. And some of them have not a leading role in the play, but are affected, right? Even like a wave pool, you know, you can kind of splash at one end of the pool and eventually see the ripples all the way across on the other end. The breath and the movement, the pulse and the vessels and the movement of these fluids of the body has interplay with these diaphragms, actively or more subtly.
So when you do a practice relating to those, is it more of a description of something that's going on, or is it something that you're influencing?
Both. I think like any experiment, once you enter into it, you are having an effect on the experiment just by observing it, right? So we start with an exercise of just slightly exaggerating the breath so you can have a relationship with these diaphragms, get to know them, say hello, reconnect with them, just have your own kind of personal experience of them. And then when you have a relationship to them, then they become super useful for things like bandhas, working with bandhas in yoga or in breathing exercises. There's a technique that Alan does. He calls it the Roto-Rooter. I don't know if you remember. I don't know if he always calls it that, but it's the three granti, the granti buster, kind of with the work of Bastrika. Well, it's very hard to find an exaggeration, a pumping Bastrika move of these diaphragms if you're not already friends with it, right? If you don't already have a relationship with it. So I think it starts by kind of exaggerating it enough that you can, you know, make friends, and then being able to work with it more on a more subtle level.
Right. Yeah. So I'm familiar with that granti, but on a practice.
That's the proper name. Roto-Rooter was perhaps not the Sanskrit.
Better image. But So in that's an example of bringing the movement of energy into the different subtle diaphragms. That's a very clear combining or describing how the physical is meeting with the energetic via a kriya practice that we would do. And then are there places where you go to this yogi perspective where it's pretty much not so related to something anatomical, but more in the realm of the energy anatomy?
Yeah, you know, it's a little less directly correlated, like organ and bandha or granti, like it is in the diaphragms, but in the digestive system. There's in the book, there's a whole chapter dedicated to agni, the concept of agni, and the concept and the physical manifestation of digestion, right? And so there's also a part where we talk about the vayus. You know, vayus are something that are, of course, in the energetic model of how these kind of currents of energy universally move through us, but also through the macrocosm, the world around. You know, there's a taking in, there's a metabolizing, there's a pooping, there's whether we're talking about food or emotions or the larger world around us, there are these plays, these flows,
right.
These currents that are universal.
Right.
And
for
so,
people who don't know, the vayus, one of them that we maybe more people have heard of is prana.
True.
And so this idea of an energy that flows, but with the vayus, there are five different kinds of energy for different functions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are with them. And so now you're talking about influencing those and understanding how they're at play in the body and also in the universe in general.
Yeah. I mean, I try to stick to the body. The universe is pretty vast.
Yes.
It's a bigger book.
And there's that whole dark matter thing.
Oh, God, don't get me started. But yeah, there are these prescribed rhythms, you know, of movement. Every mental impulse comes in through one of our organs of perception, right? That comes in, and then we got to do something with it. I think a lot of times in yoga, we talk about, you know, letting go. Oh, it's just all illusion. Just let it go. Like if I yelled at you right now, or I wouldn't, but but if, you know, it's, I don't know if it really benefits you to just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it might short term, but
unless we're using our teacher voices.
I know. I've got very teachery.
Yes.
But that's, it's
I'm
not.
I'm just letting this go.
Time is just an illusion.
Yes.
I don't know how helpful that is, right? Everything comes in and then we have to process it. We have to do something with it. There's a metabolizing and assimilative force. And then there's that has to circulate through you. So whether it's the apple you just ate or the information that we're sharing, you can assimilate it, but if it doesn't get to the cells, if it doesn't get into your life, if it doesn't spread out into your existence, how useful is that, right? So it has to circulate. There needs to be an expression of it. There needs to be kind of an embodied experience and then an expression of it. This is vital. And then there's also going to be stuff that you don't need. There's going to be stuff that you do need to let go of. There's a waste product, whether it's an apple or these concepts, right? There's a part that's, after you've fully assimilated it, there's a part that you can let go, right? And so this happens in the GI tract, you know, this happens in our small individual bodies, on a physical, but also emotional, mental level. And then I think also in the greater macrocosm, we see these happening in nature around us. Nature has a way of bringing in, taking away, expressing, circulating, and digesting, assimilating, you know, this kind of process of metabolism globally, right?
Yeah, keeping everything in balance.
Yeah, yeah. And there's that great saying that I always forget where it's from. But that which exists here exists elsewhere. That which does not exist exists nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This macrocosm is being kind of a poetic reflection of the microcosm,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa.
Yeah.
Right? What exists there exists here in my heart, in my body, in my experience.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sentiment. I just read it yesterday as related to the Mahabharata.
Yeah.
That the story is so grand that what exists is in here. Mm-hmm. Or else it does not exist.
I think I misquoted it in the first book.
Although I then went through the Kulanava Tantra, and I mean, there are statements that are close enough to that that we won't call it a misquote in your first book.
Wonderful. Let it slide.
You were quoting someone else, so can't really be blamed on you anyway.
It's all illusion.
I'm letting that go now.
Speaking of expressing and circulating, I'm here in the cafe editing this podcast, this amazing conversation with Kristen Leo. I hope you're enjoying it. This conversation comes to you because of the fantastic people who support me on Patreon. They make Peter's podcast possible, put it in your ears, put it in other people's ears. If you're already one of those people, thank you so much for your support. If you're not, please head over to patreon.com. Valuing this podcast at whatever level makes sense. Thanks so much for your support. Here's the rest of my conversation with Kristen. Enjoy.
I'm looking up at Ganesha above your head here, and Ganesha times three, at least.
Yeah, there's a few of him represented in here.
Yeah. And so writing of any book is fraught with obstacles. I had my, I wrote a book maybe 2 years ago. And, you know, I had this funny period of time where I was working at graphic design and some other art things, and the whole floor dropped out of that, you know, right around 2008 when the system crashed, the system of of our economy. And so I just started writing, and I was writing and writing and writing, 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 and I wrote just this pile of books, you know. And then I was... I found this one book and I really like this idea. It's kind of like, I was talking to Lindsay Sandwald about it, and she said, it's like your hit single book. You know, it's like, it doesn't have yoga in it. It's just kind of a, like, it's a rom-com basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? But it's not. But, so I've just been struggling with getting that book to get finished in like, for me to feel it's finished, like it's too short.
The one you released in...
No, I didn't release it yet.
Oh, this is another one.
Yeah, okay. I haven't released this book. And I keep shopping it with agents. I feel like this is the book that an agent might get interested in.
Right.
You know, and it's just something. And I think that people who write have some sense of what it takes to write books, and people who don't, they... It's like, I can't even imagine what it would be like to write a book. But having written books, I just want to congratulate you on writing another book, because it's such a big deal. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of conceptualizing all the way through to the execution. And so, brava.
Well, that's kind, but I don't consider myself a writer. And I don't know if I'd put myself in the category of that. I think for me, the process has been exhausting myself for reasons of not writing until it comes to a point where I can do nothing else but write.
Uh-huh.
So I think the last Meta Anatomy book came out in January 2014.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that it was going to be Energetic Body Something since then. We're now in 2019,
yeah.
And I think I just kept making excuses of, it's not this, it's not that, I can't do it, who am I to write it? It just, the mental gymnastics, the, you know, jiu-jitsu of the brain of trying to figure out why I shouldn't write it,
mm-hmm.
and why I was no good at writing and whatever, that it really only gelled about a year ago, when I came together kind of magically, you mm-hmm. know, in the best sense of that mm-hmm. word, that I couldn't not write it. You know, it was just, and it was less painful at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just to sit down and write it. And even though there was a lot of still, you know, inner dialogue of, you know, this will never see the light of day, and who cares about this, and is this needed, and there's so many other smarter, you know, more, you know, professional people out there that have written these wonderful textbooks on this stuff, and I'm going to write a little synopsis of it, you know. But I think it just, at a certain point, it just, not writing it is not an option.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the, you know, I wrote this book called Yoga for Artists, where I thought about the way that I use yoga to stir, you know, to calm down through all those challenging parts, you know? So like when there is this place where it's not working, it's a little bit easier to not be attached, you know, like, okay, it's either not going to work, and so then I wasn't supposed to write it, or it's going to work. And then once it's worked, it'll be like, I'll forget about this part where it wasn't working. And so,
it's like combating that kind of self-critical voice.
Exactly.
Of, you know, what are you doing here?
And if you look at like all the writings about writing, you know, all writers' stuff, everybody goes through it to some degree. They go through varying relationships with those challenging places.
Yeah.
I this summer read Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic.
Yeah. It's right there, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, she shares all of her, like, tricks of mind and how she rationalizes that it's hard and all that kind of stuff. And there's just no denying it. It's hard.
Yeah. You know?
And which is why I say congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think the discipline of it too, once you start writing, of just sitting and writing.
Yeah.
And not having it have to be good or usable, or you could throw it out, or no one has to see it ever.
Yeah.
Because more times than not, I would just make myself write, and I'd look back at it a week later, or a day later, or a month later, whatever, and it'd be like, oh, actually, that's usable in this place, or it's not horrible.
Right. It's not horrible.
That's about as good as I get. Like, well, it's not horrible.
Yeah.
So let's use that.
Yeah. That works.
Yeah, but it's just sitting and having the discipline to just battle through the inner critic.
Yes.
You know, and...
Yeah, and I know there are tons of writers who basically insist on that discipline approach. Like, I will sit at my desk every day. I will write. This is how I am a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm always a little lazy with myself, and I never had that requirement. I just wait till I'm just like in love with what I'm writing, and then I just write.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna steal another minute. She has that, like, your make your art your lover kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
I definitely related to that little part of it, but not, I didn't have to make it that. It's just when it is that, then I'm productive.
You want to spend all your time.
Yeah. So that's really cool. But then every now and then I get into the situation where I'm supposed to write something and I don't feel like it.
Of course.
And then it's really hard, you know, then that doesn't work. Although sometimes, like what you did, you go back and you look at something you wrote and you go, oh, well, I could start here.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it is this weird dance.
It is. Yeah.
So
where are you in the process then of this? Are you still?
I have two projects going. One I'm writing with Al on meditation.
Right.
And that one is due next month.
Oh.
So.
And you're saying.
So we're very far along. Yeah. I hope. Knock wood. Yeah.
Yep. So that when you have a deadline like that, that.
Then you don't have a choice to be happy about it. No, but I am happy about it. We had sort of taken a little pause, and then when the book was approved, we went back and suddenly with like new eyes, read through it again and saw, okay, let's tweak this, let's tweak that.
And what's the process with the having a publisher? Do you get much support content-wise, like editorial?
I am not sure. Mm-hmm. I just watched Wendy go through this with the Sutras book, and there was a copy editing process that didn't provide substance, like, you know, support. Only grammar, does this metaphor, am I following it, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're kind of on your own for content.
Mm-hmm.
And you're having a good process you find it easy with Alan?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Because you guys are kind of two different communicators.
Right. I think in the case of this book, it was easy because I've incorporated so much of what Al teaches.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
That piece was very easy. And then it was good to have him as the editor because we then, he would say, I don't know what you're saying, right? Like I would use my own shorthand sometimes and he would say, yeah, you have to say that in a more simple way or something, elaborate on that.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just make that point, like elaborate. And so that was useful because it encouraged me to be more conversational in the way that he is. So it was a good blend in that regard. And then he has like this handful of examples that he likes to use. So we're finding places where we can teach through examples, metaphor, ideas, you know, making solid some of these more abstract notions.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm excited. It's feeling very good and very
Are you far along. Able to say the name?
The working title is Meditation Beyond Mindfulness.
And I find that so intriguing, that concept. I don't know if you're going to go into there, if you feel comfortable talking about it currently, but the whole mindfulness revolution of bringing meditation to more people in corporate settings and kind of stripping away some of the other parts, languaging or concepts of the tradition that it came from or the traditions that it came from, and then also highlighting its physiological benefits. And I mean, which is wonderful. It's what people are going to connect to, especially in a corporate setting or for health insurance or, you know, these are good things to highlight. But it's not the whole story. It's it's only just the tip. It's like the first stage of those techniques. Is that something that you dive into in this?
We do a little bit. We talk about, I use this this old story of like somebody's looking for their keys under the lamp, you know, like a street lamp is outside and they're looking for their keys and somebody comes along and says, what are you looking for? Oh, I lost my keys. And so the guy helps look for a while and there's nothing there. And he says, where'd you lose your keys? And he says, I lost them over there by the gate, but the light is much better over here. And I feel like that's the problem with mindfulness right now.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that's easier to look at. It's easier to do a certain kind of research on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just so not the whole shebang. And so we don't spend a lot of time on that, but we have, of course, have to address it. And then we talk about yoga.
Mm.
You know? So it's very much a yoga meditation book. So
are there going to be meditations in it?
There are. Yeah. There are a few meditations in it. There's a little bit about asana and a little bit about pranayama.
Oh, nice. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, saying that the reason that yoga is so effective is because it does this preparatory work for meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Make it easier to do and make you in balance and, you know, let the energy flow in ways that lead to meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we don't really get into this, is the next thing I'm about to say, but I've been seeing more and more, and it's kind of natural, I guess, to have this kind of backlash, but a lot of people talking about the issues with mindfulness because it is getting so widespread,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not the right practice for some people straight out of the box with no support, without methods of grounding, without alternatives, you know.
And most of our minds are crazy, so we can get real familiar with it, but then what? We can get real familiar with the crazy.
Yeah.
And then if you don't have the support or any other techniques to pluck all the weeds there and observe all the patterns and then begin to shift those patterns or change your relationship to those patterns, then it leaves you a little bit high and dry.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, so what we more focus on in the book is what's there beyond getting used to who your mind is.
Yeah.
You know, like, what is this samadhi thing and what is available when you can find a connection to something that transcends, be that transcendent plus immanent person walking through the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that's the plan.
Next month, huh?
Yeah, next month. So my other book, is fiction, and I'm just shopping it. You know, I'm just sending it out. In the 6 weeks or whatever you have to wait for somebody to respond about things, you like get a chance to read through this or that again, or polish up your pitch letter.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it's a funny field. I'm do my best to stay unattached to the results of that particular field.
Well, good luck.
I feel like, you know, this is something I'm going to do regardless.
Yeah.
No one has to tell me I'm good at it or I'm successful at it or I don't have to sell X copies of things.
Mm-hmm.
I just enjoy writing it. The people who do read it say they enjoy reading it. So that's a good enough baseline.
Yeah.
Whatever else comes, great.
Yeah.
So
it's, you know, Rod talks quite a lot about, you know, entering into a field where there's no doubt, you know, when you're coming up with your intention, sankalpa, something where it can be no other way. Having that much faith or assuredness that it can be no other way, this will, you know, kind of manifest. And it's always been a really challenging concept for me and something I've also kind of bumped up against and disagreed with in the past. But there's only been a few times in my life where I've had that just kind of arising of that feeling, not a mental top-down process of like, I will manifest this, you know, but kind of a bottom-up process of that kind of arising, like it can be no other way. And those things I have seen come into my life, not on my timetable, but fairly easily without obstacle.
That's awesome.
And so I think there is something to be said of when there is a piece of art, a piece of music, a creative endeavor that arises in you, and it can be, you must finish it. And whatever, however the world accepts it, whatever format the world views it, you know, in published, unpublished, self-published, just sitting on your computer, like the urge, the desire of it being just kind of born, I think that's what's more important to me and perhaps what's more important in general of releasing the fruits of your actions.
Bhagavad Gita,
you know, just do your duty.
Right.
And I mean, I'm pretty sure wasn't talking about a book.
But yes. But to get to your book, it's a Svadhisthana thing, right?
Yeah.
It's like when the desire for something is purest.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing for you to pursue.
Yeah.
Right? That's the thing for you to manifest. And then you use other energies to make that happen.
Yeah. I wouldn't even call it pursues you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even like, I don't know.
It's karma of it all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It only happened to me maybe a handful of times where I felt that, but it can be no other way. It's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Again, never on my timeline.
Right.
And never exactly how I envisioned, you know, it perhaps. But it's going to be there. It pursues you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I think of that all as being like the interest component of life. Like we always want things to just work out the way we want them to, you know, and yet that's never the way it happens. It's always this crazy drama of things.
Twists and turns.
Yeah. And it makes me say, well, clearly then, this is the nature of life, that mm-hmm. it is this thing where we don't know what's going on and we just have to roll with it and it unfolds and we do what we think is best.
Mm-hmm.
And the learning, the great learning then is that that is the way that life works, right? Mm-hmm. You don't look for life to start working a different way. You start looking, how do I relate to that?
Mm-hmm.
And earlier today, you know, this same idea was in my head for some reason or other. And I remembered that old nursery rhyme, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. It's like, that's what you're doing. Life is carrying on.
Yeah.
You're swept up in it.
Yeah.
And the best you can do is sort of navigate the currents.
Yeah. Catch the wind, catch the current every now and then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Point the boat.
Point the boat.
Yeah.
Stop trying to swim upstream.
Yeah.
You know, and there's good stuff up ahead,
mm-hmm.
the stuff you're supposed to do.
Yeah. And use a paddle. Like,
yes.
There's help.
There are tools.
There are tools.
Use,
yeah.
Use your tools. Right.
Don't just
use your
think
words.
About
use your,
it.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. And if you go to that life is but a dream part,
mm-hmm.
you know, you bump your dream head against a dream wall, you get a dream headache. You can't just say it's the dream. So I'm not going to think about it. I don't care.
Right.
Forget about that. Just let it all go. Yeah, you know,
yeah.
So.
God, who knew that was such a profound nursery rhyme?
I did. It's in my book. I quoted it in Yoga for Artists.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gonna have to go back and look at that.
Yeah. So what else is going on? What's on the agenda for you? You're teaching around?
Teaching around. The book comes out February 3rd
mm-hmm.
into the world, and there's actually going to be a book party.
Nice.
Which I'd love for you to be there.
Yeah.
February 28th at Ishta Yoga in New York.
Awesome.
And
I know where that is.
You do, yeah.
Yeah.
Familiar. And then there's a few events around the book. There's one in Philly. Thankfully, I'll be also heading to London and Berlin in April.
Nice.
And there'll be a little bit of working with these concepts with this energetic body and how it correlates to the physical body.
Nice.
A few workshops in the next couple months.
Cool. Where are you going to do that in Berlin?
With Julie's studio,
nice.
Bija Yoga, Berlin.
Awesome.
Yeah. Which I can't wait to go back. We were talking before we started recording how much we enjoy Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't wait to get back there.
That's great.
Yeah.
And are you teaching your meta-anatomy in New York? Nothing's on the calendar right now?
We're working on dates at Ishta for
okay.
the next module. The next module will be 5 workshops relating to core. So relating to the digestive, the abdominal muscles, the psoas, the hips, and the concept of Agni.
Oh, nice.
And assimilating emotions and,
cool.
and processing. And so those would be the next series of 5 that we're going to try to get in the spring, summer of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
There's a meeting on Monday.
Nice.
To nail down some details.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Yes.
But I really enjoy those. I enjoy the people that come. The fellow nerds.
Well, I came, so
I know
that was a good thing.
It was a very good thing, but it's people that have a sincere interest and a willingness to dive into these concepts, and it's mostly teachers, so it's people that have a willingness then to share this information.
Mm-hmm.
So those are always my favorite people, the fellow kind of nerds that are down to sit for 5 hours and talk about the psoas,
mm-hmm.
and be open to, you know, 50 different perspectives on what it is, or different ways of observing or looking at it, and having their own experience in a room full of, you know, other nerds that are just as excited about it. And then can these techniques, they're not mine, they're my teachers and their teachers, but they're so immediately usable. I found that it's powerful to then, you know, get emails a week later of like, I use that with my students, and
right.
or my back doesn't hurt anymore, or I had this revelation about my relationship and
awesome.
Stuff because these techniques just work.
Yep.
They're not rocket science. You know, they're just usable, practical, profound, you know, tools that we've been lucky enough to be given. And it's nice to see them move out into the world, you know, so other people can, you know, have change, you know, have freedom, have change, have liberation. That's exciting to me.
All the way back to Jiva Mukti.
Freedom all comes
of
back.
The me.
The freedom of the me, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Kristen.
Thank you, Peter.
I look forward to your new book coming out on the shelves. Namaste.
Namaste.
That's today's episode of Peter's Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. I always enjoy talking to Kristen. I'm sure you got a lot out of that, just like I did. Look forward to talking to you soon. Have a wonderful day. Namaste.